event. It is now my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, so please offer a warm Valley Group welcome to Mark.
Thank you, Danielle. Thank you, Bill, for asking me to speak. My name is Mark. I am an alcoholic. I'm not glad to be an alcoholic, but I am ecstatic to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And it's a really good time to be a member of AA. We have a great AA community in Tulare County. Bill and I were talking before the meeting about going to meetings in other parts of California. I work up in the Bay Area, and sometimes I go to meetings up there. They're okay. But you're not missing anything, because there's great meetings in this county. My home group is the Bridge Street Drunks Only, and I was sponsoring a kid there, and his dad came out from New Hampshire, 25-year AA member from New Hampshire, and he came out to a couple of our meetings there at Bridge Street, and he told me that what you guys have going here, this is good as AA gets. And he'd been to meetings all over the country. So we're doing really well here. And if any of you were lucky enough to be at that event that Tookie Paw put on Saturday, their bad Christmas sweater party, an amazing event, their first ever event, they killed it. It was the most interesting reading of chapter 5 that I've ever heard. So we're doing well here, and it's a good time, apparently, to be a member of AA throughout the country. If you watch television, you may have seen a recent episode of NCIS. I don't watch it that often. I did when I was drinking. But the episode opens up in an AA meeting, and it turns out one of the members of the NCIS team is an AA member. And everybody's happy about it. It's all good. There was another show on recently. We were watching Bloodline on Netflix. And there's an AA meeting on Bloodline. One of their chief characters is an AA member. They look like pretty good meetings, too. So I am happy to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous today, but that wasn't always the case. I tried not to be an alcoholic for an awfully long time. I didn't come to AA until I'm 62 years old. I didn't come to AA until 2010, December 3rd of 2010. My experience, what it used to be like, which is an important part of my story. I grew up in San Francisco, one of seven kids in an Irish Catholic family. My father was an alcoholic and died of it. His father was an alcoholic and died of it. My mother's father was an alcoholic and died of it. We got seven kids in our family. Three of us are in AA, and the other four have been. Nobody drinks anymore because it's too dangerous for us. So it's a family disease. The house I grew up in was not a safe place. My father was a violent, angry, sarcastic, unpredictable drunk. Domestic violence happened in our house. Sexual abuse happened in our house. It was not a safe place to be. Now, I grew up with a couple of things. Number one was fear. There was always an undercurrent of fear in our house. Because my old man, when he came home, it was time to hide. When you heard that car door slam, find a place to go away, because you didn't want to be around him. And that's assuming he came home. Didn't always. Sometimes we had to go get him. My mom would tell us to pile into the Buick station wagon in the middle of the night, and we'd go to the police station, the emergency hospital. He'd have stitches in his face, black eyes, but we didn't know why. Because in addition to a household of fear, we had a household of secrets. So one day we'd have two cars, the next day we'd have one. You didn't ask what happened to the other car. Did you get in trouble? And he'd come home with stitches in his chin and black eyes. You didn't ask. Nobody talked about that. Nobody talked about anything in our house. You got smacked. One time he knocked me out because I was like 8 years old, making too much noise with our train set. And he'd come down and he punched me and knocked me out. Hit my head on the floor. And my mother came down and told me, be quiet, go to your room. It's never mentioned again. House of secrets. Our whole family was full of secrets. I had two uncles. They both disappeared. I don't know what happened. Nobody knows what happened to them to this day. My father's brothers. He was just at, and my godfather, Uncle John. Hey, where's Uncle John? Well, I don't know. House of secrets. You didn't ask. So that's how I grew up. And my father, he He trained me to believe certain things about myself. He used to tell me all the time, well, there was three major things. You're fat, you're dumb, you're uncoordinated. Now, he told me these things so often, I began to believe him, even as a little kid. I did things like we're at the parish picnic, and they have all these kind of events for the kids, sack races, different things. So there's a running race, and I enter the running race in my age group. I'm leading. We get towards the end of this big loop we're supposed to run, and I'm just absolutely shocked. I'm like 10 yards in the lead. So what do? I take a dive. I deliberately fall so I won't win the race because I'm not supposed to. Because that's what my father told me. And it was so, I guess it was so obvious that I did that. He comes up to me and he says, you look like you did that on purpose. So I did. I didn't even know why I did it. I just did it and I had nothing to say to him. I just walked away. So that's how I grew up. Fear, insecurity, and believing I wasn't good enough. I wasn't as good as other people. Things changed when I was 15. I went to a New Year's Eve party at this guy's house over near Golden Gate Park. And I went there for one reason, because I heard we could get beer. There were going to be older kids there, I'm going to buy us beer. And I've heard lots of stories from the older guys where I went to high school about the great time you can have on a Friday or Saturday night, go get some beer, go to a dance, meet some girls, get into some fights. It all sounded great to me. So I go to this party, and that's what happened. One of the older guys is going to make a beer run, and he asked me what I wanted. I didn't know much about drinking. I knew a lot about being drunk, because I had seen my parents drunk all the time, my old man drunk. So I asked for a six-pack of Olympia beer, which was a popular beer at that time. And the only reason I said Olympia is because I liked the TV commercials they had. I didn't know anything about beer. So the beer comes. I open my first can of Olympia. I like the taste. But what I really like is holding the can with a bunch of other people holding the cans of beer. So all of a sudden, I'm one of this group. I fit in. I just loved holding a can of beer, listening to the stories, laughing at stuff I didn't even understand. And then after about the third beer, a love affair started. I started to feel the effects of alcohol, and for the first time in my life, I can remember I wasn't afraid anymore. I didn't care if I was fat or dumb or uncoordinated. I felt just as good as anybody in that room. And everything got better. You know, we're in this guy's garage there across the street from Golden Gate Park. And the party, objectively, is pretty crummy. You know, we got some Cheetos. We got some frozen pizza. We got this record player. And Santana's playing on the record player. That was the big band at the time, 1971, Santana. And I hear Black Magic Woman, which is actually a Fleetwood Mac song, but Santana does a nice version of it. And I heard that song 100 times. But that night, I was like, God, this is good. This is the most amazing song I've ever heard in my life. So everything was better when I had that feeling. So I drank that six-pack and I drank whatever else people didn't drink. I was surprised that people would ask for a bottle of Spinata and not finish it. And they didn't mind if I drank it. So I did. I think that night I drank that six-pack. I drank some Rainer Ale, some Country Club malt liquor, some Spaniata, some Boone's Farm. It was all excellent. And I was just hammered, and I loved it. I was having a great time. I had to be home by midnight because I was 15. So I jump on the 28 bus, go down 19th Avenue, get home just before noon, and I am ripped, expecting to get into trouble. But I didn't, because my parents were drunk. And their friends that were over for New Year's Eve were drunk. So they thought it was funny that I was drunk. And they actually gave me more booze. This is amazing. So the next day I was very sick, I was very hungover, and I didn't care. I wanted to get drunk the next opportunity I had. Now it was kind of hard, because at 15 I wasn't old enough to get a job, and we didn't have much money. I would get these little jobs like cleaning up the Knights of Columbus Hall after a wedding, little goofy stuff like that. You know, make $5 or $10 handing out flyers or political leaflets, crap like that. But, you know, $5, you'd see in those days, $5 was a lot of money, because a six-pack of Coors cost $1.32. So for $5, you're good. So that was what inhibited me from drinking too much, was just the cost of it. Although, I became a thief, Catholic kid, you're not supposed to steal, but I stole. I actually stole from the church. I was helping out at a rummage sale, and I went into the kitchen at the church hall, and they had beer in the cooler, so me and a couple of friends, we lifted a couple of cases of beer right on. Stole beer out of people's garages, whatever. Didn't care. So that was the start of my drinking career. And then things even got better the next year. When I turned 16, my father left for good, which was a huge relief to our family. And the reason he left was because, when we didn't know this at the time, he just left. And we didn't see him very much after that. But he had embezzled $50,000 from this company that he worked for, and he had to go somewhere. But he left my mom as a single mom with seven kids and lots of bills and a house she couldn't really afford. So things were a little tight, but just not having him there was a good deal. So it also freed me up to do things like work. I turned 16 so I could get a job, and I needed to because we didn't have any money. My mom actually had to go back to work too. And so I had a perfect job. I went to work for a liquor store, the CB Liquors on 40th and Taravelle, and it's still there. And my job was, I'd come in after school and stock the walk-in and the shelves and stuff, and then we delivered for free. And so I would deliver booze to these drunks starting like 4 in the afternoon, you know, till 9 or 10 at night. Excellent job, because drunk people don't count their money very well. And even if they do, they're generally pretty good tippers. So I got a paycheck, and then plus what I made in tips. I usually made more in tips than I'd make in that paycheck. So life was good, because then a lot of deliveries went to me and my friends. Because I'd take the phone calls, and, you know, whatever anybody wanted. Yeah, and then the owner would be like, who was that? Oh, this guy, here's the address, I got it. You know, I'll go, and I put it together and go deliver it to my friends. Excellent deal. Now, my own drinking was still to seek drunkenness. I never liked just drinking. The first time I drank, I got drunk, and I wanted to get drunk every time I put alcohol into my system. The phenomenon of craving occurred the first time I drank and every single time I drank. Now, I didn't get drunk every time I drank, but I wanted to. It was extraordinarily difficult for me to stop drinking once that alcohol got into my system, and I never wanted to. But there are some constraints on behavior of that kind, so I didn't get drunk every time that I drank. So I didn't get into a lot of trouble. I managed to make it through high school. I went to a nearby college, San Francisco State. Eventually got out of there. It took me 6 years to get my four-year degree, because I didn't have money. I had to take semesters off to work. But I didn't get into trouble with booze in those days. And stayed completely away from drugs. And in San Francisco, the 60s and 70s, there's stuff all over the place. But it didn't interest me. The people I ran with, mostly Irish, Italian, Polish kids, we were just drunks. Not too many people got into that stuff. So life is pretty good, despite my binge drink, despite my drinking more than my other friends. It never occurred to me that I might have a problem. I just considered myself a heavy drinker, which is actually, it's a mark of prestige where I grew up with. If you're a partier, if you can put away a lot of booze, this is good for your reputation. In fact, we used to go out with the specific purpose of drinking a certain amount of booze. And people would say, well, what are you going to do tonight? I'd say, well, I'm going to do 2 6-packs. Or I'm going to do a pint of whatever. So our partying was about the amount. It was about getting drunk. Not so much about socialization. If that happened, that's cool. But we were about getting screwed up. So, life went problem-free for a while. You know, I got out of school, got the job I wanted, but I would still want to get drunk on my days off, because no matter what happened in my life, it just seemed like it wasn't enough. I never really felt good. I always thought things like, well, once I get out of college, I'll feel good, life will be complete, and then I'll really have it made. And then I get out of college, and I don't feel any different. So I get this job I want, and I think I'm finally set in life, but I still don't feel any different. I still feel like there's something missing. So my escape was always to drink. If I could drink, then I didn't care what else happened. But I pursued the other things that seemed like they should make me happy. Because I saw other people that they got married, and they seemed to be happier than I was. I wasn't very good at relationships. I couldn't make anything work for more than a few months. But eventually, I found a woman that was willing to enter into marriage with me. And so I thought, well, this will be the key. Once I can get married, then life will be good and I'll be happy. And I did get married. And it's good. It was good. But I still felt like there was something missing. And I didn't drop this habit of getting drunk. And I wasn't sure why. I felt like, well, other people aren't doing that, but I still have this need, if I have a day off, to start drinking and just get falling down drunk. And unfortunately for her, my wife at the time, she liked to drink a lot too. So there was nobody to hold me accountable. And I was lucky enough not to get into trouble, not to get arrested or get into trouble at work. So I became a weekend alcoholic, and I did that for a really long time. Eventually we had a couple of kids. Having that responsibility kept me in line to a degree. But if I have spare time, if I have some days off, I'm going to get drunk. That's my plan, and I would plan these things meticulously. Even if my life is going perfectly, work's going good, marriage is going good, kids are okay, 2 days before I have some time off, I'm planning what I'm going to drink and what amounts and what, if any, food I'm going to have with it. And then I'm going to carry out my plan. And on my days off, you know, my family got used to the fact, well, Dad's going to get drunk today, so, you know, we're on our own. I didn't think this was selfish. I just felt like this was a form of stress relief because I have a very stressful job. And if I have some friends over and we get hammered, this is our way of blowing off a little steam, clearing my mind so that when I go back to work after these days off, then I'll be able to start with a fresh mind. And that was all bullshit, but I believed it. And I went that way for a long time as a weekend alcoholic. And eventually things caught up with me because my wife got tired of my act. She found a job out of state and she left. I don't recall being terribly saddened over it because we weren't getting along anyway. So I just, well, okay. And that was actually good for me in a way because being a single parent, because both of my kids were still in school, one in junior high and one just starting high school. So I had some responsibilities to keep me in line. And so I couldn't be drunk all the time. I had to take kids to school, to practice, to their different events. They were involved in swimming and band and all these things. But I wasn't a model parent. You know, if you're going to the teen party at Chuck E. Cheese, you probably shouldn't be drinking box wine. And I, when I went in there, I was all depressed because I don't like going to Chuck E. Cheese. But when I found out they had wine, I was like, well, this isn't so bad. And it's not appropriate behavior, but I did it anyway. You know, I tell them, hey, put it in a soda cup. And, you know, going to the team parties at Roller Town and stuff, and I'd have a bottle in my car, and I would, like, tell people, oh, yeah, I'll be back in a second, go use the restroom. I'd go back in my car and chug vodka out of the bottle and come back into the Roller Town. That's what kind of a parent I was, because I had to drink. Now, I still want to take care of my responsibilities, but I have to drink at this point. So then, kind of a bad thing happened for me. I had 30 years in at this job that I had worked, and they told me I could retire. And I wasn't liking the job anyway, so I took them up on it. So I'm going to retire. This was in 2009. And I was looking forward to it because I thought, well, I'll finally be able to do what I want. They're still going to send me a paycheck, apparently, every month. And I don't have to go to work. And now I can just relax and take it easy. I can travel if I want to. I can do all this hiking and fishing and all this crap that I put off doing. And I had visions of sitting on my patio on a summer's day and reading a good book and listening to some jazz on the stereo and having a cool gin and tonic of an afternoon And that happened a couple of times. But most of the time what happened is I just get drunk and I can't read the book anymore and I don't give a crap what's on the stereo. I'm just drunk. Because at this point, I'm living by myself. My kids are up and grown. My son signed up to the Marine Corps and he went away. My daughter's out on her own. It's just me and the dog and the bottle. And it's not working out. You know, there's a one of the stories in our book mentions a guy that he got into some trouble drinking, and then he didn't drink for 25 years. And then when he picked up that bottle upon retirement, he was dead within a couple of years. It says he put on his carpet slippers and picked up the bottle. Well, that's kind of what I did, except I didn't die all the way. So I get to a point, and it didn't take long. And I did some of the cool things I had planned to do. I took my mother over to Italy to see the Pope. Because she's Catholic, she always wanted to see the Pope. So we go over there, it's all good, except she broke her arm going to the Vatican Museum. That wasn't so good, we had to come back early. But she still got to see the Pope. And I did do some hiking and fishing and crap. But I found out that the only reason those things were special is because I couldn't do them all the time when I was working. And once I could do them all the time, I quickly got bored. And the only cure I had for boredom was to drink. So after about 6 months, I didn't want to really do anything. So I'd sit home and drink by myself, except for the dog. And I spent an awful lot of time in my bedroom with a half a gallon of vodka, drinking it out of the bottle and watching endless reruns of NCIS. Because I identified with Agent Gibbs because he got to drink whiskey in his basement and build boats. And he was a loner and he always caught the bad guys. And I liked that. And it was really pathetic because my daughter periodically would come over and check up on me. And she tells me this, you know, she tells me now how I used to act. She'd come over, didn't matter what time of day it was. She'd come over and I kind of stumble out of the bedroom and she'd look at me. Oh, how's it going, Dad? Oh man, it's really cool, Gibbs, man. He got these guys in, and she said, you know, I'd be telling her stories about what happened on NCIS in 2008. That was my life. And so, both of my kids ended up calling me on and said, Dad, you think you're drinking too much? And it's okay, I'll clean up. And I did. I would quit for like a week, thus proving I wasn't an alcoholic, and then go on to a program of highly disciplined drinking. Like, I got these liquor bottles lined up, and I would draw lines on them. Okay, and so today I shall only drink to this line and no farther. And I would do that for like 3 days, and then on the third day I said, well, that's bullshit, I'm okay, I've already proved I'm not an alcoholic, and then I'd go past the line, drink the bottle, and be drunk again. I couldn't stay quit. I could quit for a week or a month, but then I just couldn't stand sobriety. I hated being sober. After about a month is all I could go. And then I'd feel so pissed off. I just hate the world. I'd hate my life. I hate everybody in the world. I know the quick cure for that, which is to drink. Because I know that after about 2 or 3 drinks, all of those bad feelings are going to go away. And I'm going to feel better again, and life is going to be good. Unfortunately, I won't be able to stop because that's my history. So I would go through these periods of sobriety and then back to drinking again. And I finally got so sick of that roller coaster, I decided to get some help. But not for alcoholism. I thought that because my job had been so stressful that I either had depression or PTSD. So I went to a therapist. And what I really wanted was something to help me sleep, some kind of drugs or something, because after a month without drinking, I couldn't sleep, I couldn't focus, I'd have these panic attacks. Things got really bad without alcohol. So I go to this therapist and I tell him what's going on, and I was actually honest with him about why I had quit drinking. I told him about the amounts, because I was drinking about a half gallon of vodka a day. And he says, well, I don't think you have depression or PTSD. I think what you have is post-acute withdrawal syndrome. Because you have been drinking alcoholically, and that's what happens when you stop drinking. Your body and your brain goes through this withdrawal process. And I said, that's not even possible because I haven't had a drink for 30 days. So I'm clearly not an alcoholic. And he wanted me to go to an inpatient program, which I refused to do. He wanted me to go to an outpatient program, and I refused to do it. I did concede to go to a few AA meetings, and I went to a few meetings at the Alano Club. I didn't like it because I went there to hear, what is the secret to not drink? What is the secret to not want to drink? And I heard about God. I heard about sponsorship. I heard about the steps. And in my mind, that's got nothing to do with drinking. That's some kind of religious stuff. I've had enough of religion. I want to hear what the secret is. But I didn't hear it. Actually, I did. But I didn't ask anybody for help there. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't do the steps. In fact, I didn't say anything except one time I announced myself as an alcoholic simply because I thought people would call me out on it sooner or later. Yeah, I mean, the Alano Club, I didn't care. So I stuck around there for 4 months. I didn't drink for 4 months, and it was torture. I hated my life. I was completely stressed out. I couldn't sleep, couldn't eat, couldn't focus on anything. And I said, hell with this. I'm going to start drinking again. And I did. And it was immediately back to being drunk around the clock. And I drank for almost 7 months straight. And I'd come to this moment of truth every day. You know, I'd wake up or come to, it was about 3 or 4 in the morning, sick, shaky. And there's that bottle beside my bed, a half gallon of semi-cheap vodka. And I know two things are true. If I take a drink off that bottle, I'm going to feel better in about a minute. And I'm not going to care about anything else. That's true. The other thing that's true is, if I take that drink, I'm not going to be able to stop. And I'm going to be drunk for another 24 hours. And I'm going to face the same decision the next day, and I'm going to make the same wrong decision. Because I had lost the power of choice in drink. I was completely addicted to booze, and there was not a damn thing I could do about it. And I wanted to. So I went that way for a while, till my daughter became so concerned, she made a phone call without telling me. And on December 3rd, a guy shows up at my house at 8 o'clock in the morning. Now, I had woke up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and the only reason I wasn't drunk that morning was because I run out of booze. So I get up at 8 o'clock in the morning, and there's a knock at the door. Well, by this time, I don't have any friends. And it's too early for the Jehovah's Witnesses to be there, so I don't know who the hell this is. Well, it's this AA guy that my daughter called. And I know who he is, because he's been over our house, like a friend of the family type thing. But it was a weird deal, because when I woke up that morning, I knew I had been drunk for a while, but I didn't know how long. But I was thinking it was like a Monday, so I'm feeling like crap. I go out to the driveway to get the newspaper, and there's lots of newspapers, and some of them are yellow. So I pick up all these papers, and I take the freshest looking one and open it, and I've lost like 4 days. I don't know what the hell happened during those 4 days. I know I went out and got more booze and drank it, but I don't know where. And I'm just looking at this paper going, I can't do this anymore. I don't know what I'm going to do. But I had a moment of clarity there that said, I've got to get some help. I don't know how or when or how it's going to happen. But then God intervenes on my behalf, because right after I'm looking at that newspaper, the doorbell, the knock at the door. And it's this AA guy. And I didn't know he was coming, but I knew why he was there. And all he says is, hey, you want to talk? And I said, yeah. My saying yes was a gift from God, that gift of willingness, that initial gift of willingness. Because if he had come the day before when I was still drunk, I would say, get the fuck out of here. I don't talk to you. That wasn't nice when I was drunk. I would have thrown him off the property. But I invited him in, and we talked for 3 hours. And he says, here's your choices. You can go on the way you're going, trying to quit on your own, and the same thing will happen. He says, you can try AA on your own. You already did that. You wouldn't get a sponsor. You wouldn't do the steps. That's probably not going to work for you again. I suggest you go to an inpatient rehab facility, because you got to get out of your house. You drink in your house. You get drunk in your house. You got to get out of there. You got to get somewhere else. Well, I didn't want to go, but I knew I had to do something. Well, I got a brother that's been in AA a long time. At that point, he'd been in AA about 20 years. So I called up my brother and said, hey, you know, I'm having all this problem with booze. And my brother had never mentioned drinking to me, ever. He knew I was a drunk, but he never said anything. So I call him up. I say, hey, man, I'm in really bad shape here. AA guy's over here. He says I should go to inpatient rehab. And he goes, yeah, you should. I go, yeah, but see, here's the thing, man. It's like Friday. I haven't paid bills for a while, and I'm thinking maybe I should go next week so I can tie up these loose ends. And he says, no, don't. Go now. Because this guy tells me, the AA guy says, hey, it's a Friday. He says, I can get you in tomorrow. I'll make some phone calls. We'll go up tomorrow. And my brother says, yeah, do that. So I said, okay. And he says, but I'll tell you something. When you get to that place, there's certain things you're not going to need there. So leave your ego at the door. You won't need it. Leave your expectations at the door. And leave your attitude at the door. And when you go in there, listen to them. Do what they tell you to do. And if you can do that, that would be the best decision you ever made in your life. And he was right. Because it was. The place I went to is a place called Changing Echoes up near Angels Camp. It's a 12-step program. We did a program in there called Back to the Basics, where we went through the 12 steps as a group. It was an amazing experience. I loved that place. Rehabs have a bad rep. I loved being in that place. Now, as soon as I got out of there, I did everything I was told to do. I got a sponsor and I started working through the steps. And that's where the relief is. Because after about a month, I didn't want to drink anymore. I could sleep. I could eat. I could focus.